Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CIO House View monthly live stream. Today is Thursday, March 6th, 2025. It's 1 p.m. here in New York City. I'm Anthony Pastore, your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Thank you so much for joining us. I am joined here in the studio by my Chief Investment Office colleagues, Jason Dreho and Nadia Lovell. Got lots of questions for the two of them, and I'm sure you do as well. So we'll be asking you at some point to send your questions in. You can do that on the Ask a Question button, which is right now on your screen. So feel free to click that button and engage with us during the discussion today. We'll get that fed to us here in the room on a monitor just below our feet. So we'll get into that in a little bit. But I want to start, first of all, by telling you, our audience, this is a live show. And as we're going to talk about here with Jason and Nadia, there's a lot that's happening in the world of headlines, especially when it comes to tariffs. So we will be checking our headlines and our feeds on all of our devices here, as will my team in the control room, to see if anything's changing while we're talking. But Jason, as we sit here today, many of our viewers are aware that we're constantly watching the headlines on the tariffs, particularly Mexico, Canada, China, right? But Mexico, Canada, it's been in and out. Then just about an hour ago or so, President Trump came out and said he postponed 25% tariffs on most goods from Mexico after having a conversation with that country's president. Regardless of what the actual tariff scenario is at this moment, what is the Chief Investment Office's view on tariffs, the risks, and what we can expect for the markets?
Well, it's obviously a very fluid situation. And when that happens, you know, you don't want to get sort of caught sort of chasing your own tail or reacting to the last headline. You know, when we kind of go back a couple of months ago and thinking about what is our framework for tariffs, how this all play out, you know, we had a view that for countries like Canada, Mexico, you know, everyone sort of but China, a lot of the approach to tariffs was a sort of an escalate to de-escalate. So you use tariffs to escalate, get the concessions you want, and you de-escalate the situation. If we think about what's happened just in the past roughly 48 hours with Canada and Mexico, tariffs were in place for a day before they were pulled back on autos and now maybe on most goods from Mexico. Still waiting to see if that would the same would happen to Canada as well. So big picture is still consistent with that framework. This is a negotiating ploy, escalate to de-escalate. It's also consistent with the view that if tariffs were imposed on Canada and Mexico, we always view those as being, again, temporary. So, you know, a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of days in this case, but they wouldn't be done indefinitely. And again, that's consistent with that. Whereas we haven't seen the same situation with China. Tariffs have been added to China a month ago, and again this week, there's been no talk of sort of, you know, bringing them back. So if you think of that, that's a lot consistent with our base case, that you'd get aggressive action on tariffs, particularly with China. They would continue to escalate to sort of decouple. With other places, it'd be more selective in certain goods or certain industries. So again, kind of consistent with that. Now, actually going forward with a 25% tariff on Canada, Mexico, and while there's a temporary reprieve, perhaps that could continue, I'd say it's a little bit beyond what our base case was. Our bear case for tariffs would be like a universal tariff across the board. We're not there, but it's, you know, a little bit more than I'd say what is our base case. But I say all this in the context, like, given all the news flow, let's kind of make sure that we put it in context and have a framework to assess it. What we know now, though, is there's a reprieve only till April 2nd. On April 1st, President Trump has asked his various economics departments, Trade Representative, Commerce Department, others, to report back on different countries' trade practices, you know, what they're doing, tariffs, non-tariffs, and use that as a basis for introducing reciprocal tariffs that he's talked about. Now, what that entails remains to be seen because different countries and different rules apply. For Canada and Mexico, there is a free trade deal, so that might mean that ultimately most things would be exempt, but time will tell. Maybe certain areas where there's non-tariff barriers. Just in terms of the economic impact, look, there's uncertainty. This is clearly already kind of weighing on activity. We got data this morning on January trade data. Mm-hmm. The U.S. trade deficit increased, which of course could fuel, you know, tariffs, but it's increased because companies are front running. They're bringing stuff in before the tariffs, you know, kind of get impacted. If the tariffs are as long as 2 days, you know, it's disruptive, but it's not really changing the overall economic trajectory. If it's a couple of months, that starts to become, you know, more significant. If it's permanent in place, these tariffs, well, then you have to really start to think about U.S. growth and you know, significantly slower and growth in Canada and Mexico, ultimately perhaps being in a recession. Right. So it really depends on the duration and the magnitude of those tariffs in terms of the impact.
Yeah, and let's fast forward then to the part where we ask about the economy, because you kind of touched on that a little bit. And, you know, given that there is so much, as you said, uncertainty, as well as the speed of which things are happening, the executive orders, these tariff, will they, won't they, pauses, actually hitting the button to make them happen. Could this significantly impact the U.S. economy if we see continued fast and sort of unexpected actions by the government?
So what we know is that there's a policy uncertainty index, and that is about as high as it's if not ever been, but like other than the pandemic in March of 2020, it's never been this high, mm-hmm. which makes sense given the news flow that's coming in. It's kind of almost a matter of faith that, you know, the more uncertainty it is, the more people are going to be a little bit cautious in taking actions. And you've seen sentiment measures for businesses and consumers, you know, pulling back in the latest readings, just because it's like there's so much noise, how to sort of, you know, take this into account. It's one thing to sort of, you know, feel a little, you know, more cautious. It's another whether it's actually changing behavior. So in the real sort of activity data, what we've seen is definitely a pullback in sentiment. Not yet clear signs of really altering sort of the kind of economic trajectory for the U.S. I mean, at the margins, we have gotten sort of consumption data for January that was below expectations. I think it's tough to say that's due to tariff concerns and policy concerns. Put in the context of that, in the second half last year, the consumers in the U.S. spent quite a bit, certainly in the fourth quarter. So pullback in January due to seasonal factors, much of the country was actually unusually cold. That could impact spending. For context, in the second half of last year, real consumption spending kind of increased on an annualized basis of over 4%. So a pullback in January is not sort of surprising. Whether this continues, that's kind of, you know, that could raise some risks. But it's important to understand that the U.S. economy was in good shape at the start of this year. A lot of expectations, you know, economists were forecasting growth of around about 2.5%. Maybe that's going to be dialed back a little bit, but we're still on track to be growing around 2% this year. If these tariffs, if other trade uncertainty, if other policy uncertainty, if DOGE activities just kind of create uncertainty, there's certainly more downside risks. So the risks are definitely skewed to the downside at this point in time. But I think it would take something much more significant that's already happened to, you know, push the U.S. economy closer to recession. It's just taking off from like good trajectory to a little bit slower, but definitely more risks to the downside than the upside at this
right.
point in time.
And, you know, we've got a Fed meeting coming up shortly in the 18th and 19th of this month. And subsequently, yesterday afternoon, the Fed Beige Book came out. And among other things, they said that economic activity was slightly higher, but that there is broad concern around the tariffs. The Fed was saying that over the last couple of weeks here, all the different districts, many expecting to raise prices or have raised prices. So that said, what now does the Fed have to do? I know our CIO base case here is still for 50 basis points of cuts this year. What do you think the Fed outlook is given what's going on right now?
Well, the Fed in some ways has been in a fortunate situation for investors as well, that when they cut in December, we knew they'd go into a pause for a period of time. The economic data has been sort of benign enough. Inflation's still going a little bit lower. Labor market's been resilient. They've been able to, you know, pause and assess. So it's just been like one less thing that the markets have had to worry about, is the Fed going to cut or not?
Mm-hmm.
At some point, that will change as we move forward. So the question, how does all this happening, what's happening now, alter our expectations for the Fed's, you said 50 basis points in June and September? They're kind of just dueling factors, right? If you have higher tariffs, that's certainly going to be more inflationary in the short term. It's hard for the Fed to cut when inflation is going higher. At the same time, the Fed has already said in the past that they would probably look through, you know, tariff-related inflation, because ultimately kind of it washes through. So it's a kind of a sales tax, you know, it's a one-off price increase, and then you kind of go forward. So the Fed wouldn't necessarily hike. It may delay cuts. The countervailing force is that the Fed cares not only about price stability, but also full employment. So if you see no real weakness in the labor market as inflation goes higher, it's really hard for the Fed to justify cuts at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you see job cuts happening, if hiring slows down, and we can sign out as soon as tomorrow what the February payrolls report, if it's been impacted, then the Fed could have a justification for saying, we don't think this inflation is going to last, the economy is slowing, labor market's weakening, we have to act. If you look at market pricing, it's now up to about 3 cuts this year, and about a 50% chance of a cut already in early May. I think things would have to deteriorate quite a bit for that to happen, but that's sort of where the market is. I think we're still kind of comfortable at the moment, given all the uncertainty with the June and September timeframe. But it's very dependent on how all this plays out and how the economy reacts to the other policy uncertainty.
Right. And just to keep it in check, the European Central Bank this morning did cut rates by 25 basis points because we are tracking the other central banks around the world. And just as a quick follow-up, I don't know if there's any information out there on this, but there have been a number of cuts within the government, job cuts, I should say. Could that potentially impact the jobs numbers that we see coming out either tomorrow or next month?
Well, maybe the best real-time measure for that is looking at the initial jobless claims that comes out every Thursday morning at 8:30.
Mm-hmm.
They ticked up a little bit last Thursday, which, you know, you might look, oh, this is a sign of those DOGE cuts having an impact. This time month, like this week, it ticked down again, sort of more in line with where it's been. You can see certainly in the Washington, D.C. region a bit of an uptick, but not enough to move things nationally. So no real signs yet that Doge cuts are having a broad-based measure, mm-hmm. enough that would like really kind of alter the data. And, right. and like, there's a lot of headlines on Doge. I think the reality in terms, at least in terms of like the dollar value of cuts is in the low billions. And it's not as much as people say.
Right.
Not trivial for people who are impacted whatsoever, but just put in the context of an overall economy that's every month might create and destroy over 3 or 4 million jobs. You know, 10,000 government employees is not necessarily moving the needle dramatically on
Thank
that.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to ask that in the context of what Fed expectations might be or what they might be looking at, as jobs and inflation are two of the biggest pieces of data that the Fed is consistently looking at. Thank you, Jason. Just a quick reminder, everybody, if you have a question while we're chatting here, please send it in. Click that Ask a Question button right there on your screen, and we'll get to those shortly. Now I'd like to bring my friend Nadia in. Nadia, how are you? Good to see you. Another big development over the last week, and you know, I think many of us have seen either the headlines or watched the clip between the meeting between President Trump and, of course, Ukrainian President Zelensky. Keeping you know our thoughts and opinions outside of that, really we look at how that could impact the investing side, particularly with European equities. What's the CIO view? Has it changed at all since that meeting, or subsequently since what's happened afterwards?
Yeah, that's an important question, Anthony. I think that right now it still remains to be seen if you can ultimately get a peace deal or ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia. Will you get a quick answer to that? Probably not, just given the fact that you have these two nations that are very far apart ideologically. But what it does say to us is that we probably will see some sort of a deal this year. Again, wildly uncertain. Mm-hmm. But I think what's clear now is that as the U.S. is pulling back defense support, Europe as a region has to step up its defense spending and its security support as well and its efforts around that. I mean, so far, we've already seen announcements from the likes of the U.K. as well as Denmark. Germany has also have some plans put in place that we'll talk about in a bit. And also, you know, we would probably see more NATO members in Europe also step up defense spending. Right now, the market is sort of focused on, you know, whether you could see any sort of potential, you know, borrowing across Europe, united borrowing, to be able to increase defense spending. But from an equity market standpoint, mm-hmm. you know, we do think that there are opportunities in Europe. Specifically, we are looking at companies within our six ways to invest in Europe framework, as well as we do also have a positive tactical view on Germany. And recently we upgraded our view to attractive on European industrials. Now let me unpack that view on the six ways to invest in Europe specifically. I mean, first we think that, you know, we could see a cyclical recovery within Europe. Remember the last couple of years in Europe has sort of been in this downturn, and now there are signs that the bottom might be in and we're seeing a recovery in earnings. There are signs of potential rebound in manufacturing. So who does that benefit? That benefits the most cyclical sectors within Europe. So think industrials, consumer discretionary, as well as materials. I mean, we also are looking at post-election beneficiaries in Germany. Now, you know, in the last couple of days, Germany is having its whatever it takes moment, really. You know, there are plans at works to potentially have a 500 billion euro special purpose fund focus on infrastructure investing. There's also talks about, you know, debt breaks reform, as well as increasing the defense spending and basically doing away around defense spending in terms of having those strict rules that Germany has around its fiscal discipline and removing defense spending from that equation. And so that will be voted on next week. So there's more to come on that. But who does that benefit? It really is those sectors that have exposure to construction, renewable energy, industrial as well as those defense companies. We also think, as I noted earlier, we think that, you know, there's going to be rising security investments within Europe. You do have some countries that are still below that 2% of GDP defense spending that the NATO target has. And so you could see countries start to step up to that. There are talks about countries increasing defense spending to 3% of GDP, even 5% of GDP. So again, that should be a positive for some of those companies that are in that. Also, you know, if you do you see any sort of peace deal, again, still highly uncertain, then you could start to see that rebuilding of Ukraine. Remember, we're 3 years into this war, and there's been a lot of attacks on critical infrastructure and buildings within Ukraine. And so if we do see that rebuilding effort starts, that is going to be a increased demand for cement companies and, you know, building materials. And also, a peace deal could help at some point lower energy costs. Yes, we have seen that spike, initial spike that you had in oil and gas prices 3 years ago when Russia invaded Ukraine. It's since come down, but it still remains above where it was pre-war. Mm. And so that could be beneficial for those industries. So think about autos, think about chemicals and material companies that uses gas as a feedstock. Those could benefit an energy intensive. And I think also lastly, as we've talked about right now, you know, we are in an environment where we're likely to see increased trade tensions and tariffs. And so we're also looking at those companies that are more insulated from the potential increased tariffs. So those domestically facing industries within Europe. So think, you know, telecom, think financials, real estate, utilities, and healthcare services. These are the sort of companies that we're looking for in that framework and investing in Europe. So we think that there are opportunities, you have to be selective.
Yeah, no, that's a great rundown, Nadia. And I also, you know, that's a big question. I know a lot of our clients are asking about opportunities outside the U.S. I think they're afraid of the tariffs and how it could impact investing here. So obviously there are lots of opportunities, ex-U.S., international, as you mentioned, and even within the EM space. So thank you for that, Nadia. And, you know, one of the other big developments, I think, over the past week or 2 weeks or so is we've heard so much about the advancements in artificial intelligence. I mean, my gosh, it is exponential in the way things move. And now DeepSeek has really disrupted a disruptive sector that is, you know, already disruptive. It's sparking conversations here in our rooms. Mm-hmm. It's sparking conversations with clients. I think the question is, should tech investors be concerned given the consistently changing landscape, this DeepSeek lower cost, lower energy usage artificial intelligence platform? What are our thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, Anthony, as you noted, there have been a number of things plaguing tech as late, the DeepSeek, of course, and what that means for the intense cap and spending cycle that we've seen in the U.S. over the last couple of years that's really fueling AI and what that means going forward, as well as what the future value of these frontier AI models could mean. We also have, you know, looming in the background, Anthony, let's not forget the AI diffusion rule cap that was issued under Biden in January, that is set to go in effect in May, and that could curb, you know, AI technology exports to other countries, including some of our allies. But what does that mean in the context of our overall structural view on tech and AI? Hasn't really changed it that much. We still believe in the AI story. We think that the low-cost models like DeepSeek and others that will emerge, what that will likely do is increase demand for the adoption rate of AI. We see that with in new technologies all the time. As price comes down, you know, you see the demand increases, and that overall oversets the initial price decrease. So we think that that's still there and intact. And when you think about it, what we've heard throughout the earnings season is the continued demand for AI, the supply constraint, and also CapEx being continuing to go up. And so in our core view, our estimates for this year for CapEx by those four large hyperscalers, those cloud service providers like Amazon, Google, Meta, and Microsoft, we think that they're going to spend over $300 billion on CapEx this year. That's a 35% increase year over year. But at the same time, it's not lost on us, Anthony, that the fact that you do have these low-cost models now in the market, and that does have implications and does question the economics, the future economics for those frontier models. But again, as we transition from that training aspect to that inference, is the actual use of AI that requires compute power. You know, in fact, last week we heard NVIDIA say that those reasoning models are going to require 100 times or the magnitude of compute power. And so, you know, you even have the likes of BABA also increasing CapEx, expected to spend over $50 billion in the next 3 years, more than it spent in collectively in the last 10 years. So my point is there's still a demand. But I think that, Anthony, what we need to emphasize here is that importance of taking a diversified approach to AI and investing. AI isn't just about tech. It isn't just about the U.S. And that's why we also have a positive view on China internet. And so we think that it's important to have exposure across the value chain. We are more focused on those companies that are have integrated models that have exposure to the enabling layer as well as the application layer, Anthony. So there's still more upside, we think, to the tech AI story. But again, it also encompasses power and resources, because right. You need power to power these chips. And so we want to make sure that you have exposure across all of those areas of AI.
But does that DeepSeek technology, because what we heard from the company is that it uses significantly less energy versus existing AI platforms, does that perhaps change the game when it comes to future versions of whether it's ChatGPT or Perplexity or other platforms that are using lots of energy today where they could use less and less over time?
Over time, it could mean that the more efficient use of energy, mm-hmm. but it doesn't change the equation that you and I are probably going to be more even more avid users of AI. So it's that application of AI that still we think is going to be a larger opportunity. Now, there are always going to be more lower cost models coming to market. Even mm-hmm. this week, you've heard from BABA. Even this morning, I heard a new one, Manus, that's also, again, more efficient than DeepSeek. So technology does not stop. Innovation does not stop. But the access, right? It increases the access to that innovation. And we think that that's what's getting accelerated too.
Excellent. And just kind of broadening it out a little bit with you, Nadia, just on overall U.S. equities, if we stick with the NASDAQ and technology for a moment, it is already down 6.2% for the year. We have seen some struggling of some of the names within the Mag 7. Obviously, there's these disruptors, but you've made a very good base case for where we go from here. But given some of the other sectors and what else we're looking at, there's a lot of headwinds out there. You know, we're looking at this rapid rise in interest rates. I mean, the 10-year yield today is back up. Hotter inflation, these tariff announcements, everything that's uncertain. What's the overall view on U.S. equities right now from CIO?
Look, you know, tech is not insulated from the volatility, and I think that you have to use that volatility to your advantage to use things like structured products as well as, you know, to buy quality names. Look, the market has been climbing into this wall of worry, and reality is this wall could get steeper and it could get higher in coming weeks. We messaged that coming into this year that we thought that the market would be more volatile in 2025. We're seeing that play out. And we have to be cognizant of the fact that volatility could continue to increase and persist over the next couple of weeks. We have tariffs, more tariffs coming on, you know, April 1st, April 2nd. I think there's also another date, Jason, March 12th or something in terms of steel and aluminum. So there are all these. And then we have the budget reconciliation.
Yeah, the train never stops, does it?
So my point is that we have been advising investors to prepare for volatility, right. And that's here. And so how do you manage through that volatility? We emphasize, you know, capital protection strategies, you know, being able to hedge some of that downside exposure to manage through the risk. I would also, you know, so I would say, but that's near term. Near term volatility is here. Near term, you're probably going to see some downside risk. However, we do still have a constructive view on U.S. equities over the next 6 to 12 months. Why? As Jason noted earlier as well, that the economy is coming into this period of uncertainty from a position of strength. We've had above trend growth for quite some time. Corporate profits were quite strong in the last quarter. And so we think that that ultimately will be what leads this market higher in the later part of this year. But right now, we have to get through this period. So, you know, I would emphasize some of our attractive sectors, particularly those defensive ones, like healthcare and utilities, because we thought that the valuation was quite suppressed and we thought that there was room for a re-rating of that sector, and we're seeing that right now. And so those are some of the areas I would look at. Also, you know, financials. Financials have done well. It's given back some in the last few days as, you know, there's increasing concerns about the economy and what tariffs could do to economic growth. But when you think about financials is also a sector that can benefit from deregulation and the potential for easing of some of those capital requirements and therefore cause an increase of capital returns to shareholders. So I think you have to take a balanced approach right now to the market in terms of sector exposure, but also, you know, use hedging strategies to be able to manage some of that volatility near term.
Great. Thank you, Nadia. Go ahead, Jason, I have one more question for you. We've got a couple questions coming in. Based on everything, so Nadia covered U.S. equities really beautifully. Now we've got, there are other asset classes, there's other sectors out there that we're looking at. What opportunities do you see there, even given all the uncertainty and this volatility?
So when you think about making decisions to your portfolio, and there's a lot of uncertainty, we've covered this extensively during the call, that you also don't want to overreact to the information, sort of, you know, make rash decisions. One of the consequences of volatility is that markets tend to move very fast, they can overshoot, and they can reverse very quickly. Mm. We don't need policy uncertainty to get that. We just go back to last July and August when there's concerns about growth. In a 2.5 week period, the S&P 500 was down 10% on a bad jobs data point. And then within about 2 weeks, it almost fully recovered. So you can see that even with all the policy uncertainty. And given all the policy uncertainty we've had, we've not had that kind of move, but it's certainly in the scope. And just like you shouldn't have overreacted last summer, I think don't want to overreact to this. All which is the context of when you think about what you should be doing, make sure, like, first of all, your portfolio is diversified, you know, in equities, U.S. equities, global equities, but again, sort of on a multi-asset perspective. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, an overall sort of, you know, common sense statement. Mm-hmm. We think about fixed income and the opportunities there. Like, there's a lot of volatility, a lot of uncertainty. So, you know, sticking with kind of higher quality, sort of seeking what we say durable income. That's a key message we have right now. Higher quality spread, fixed income products. As rates have fallen in the past few weeks, what you haven't seen is spreads necessarily widen out for a lot of kind of, you know, credit, which means that, you know, some way you're getting less compensation for overall yields for the risk you're taking. So no need to kind of get too risky in fixed income, you know, by and large. And given that rates have fallen, if things sort of stabilize, and there's a good chance they certainly could in another month or two, rates could back up. So no need to take a lot of interest rate risk as you move around. That's why we still kind of favor more intermediate parts of kind of, you know, 5 to 7 year, you know, kind of within your fixed income. We touched on gold a little bit earlier. Like, you know, gold has done well, as you mentioned earlier, like recently. It's a good diversifier. There's a secular tailwind for gold as central banks around the world are buying gold to sort of diversify their reserves. Nadia touched on structured solutions. So if you want to kind of, you know, hedge downside, maybe give up some upside if you're uncertain, that's a good way to kind of map out a little more defined way what your risk profile, what your return profile would be. You know, these are, there's you know, some you have to pay for, but again, you can manage your sort of expectations, you know, overall. But the key thing, again, is like not to make sort of extreme decisions given this uncertainty. Stay invested. Ultimately, we think, you know, once we get through a lot of this policy uncertainty, the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, the AI theme that Nadia talked about, they're still supportive for risk assets. But it may take a couple more months of real choppiness before that sort of better picture starts to emerge later this year.
Right. I mean, looking at, I just took a look at the VIX, which is the volatility index, because you talked about August with that jobs print that was really roiling the markets. And obviously, it was the volatility spiked. And we're looking at it today. It's about half of where it was then, but still well off of the lows that we saw at the end of last year. So something to obviously keep track of is that volatility within the markets. Thank you, Jason. Okay, so let's go to Q&A. I think we have time for at least one here. Jason, this one's for you. Do we foresee a worst case scenario playing out between the job cuts and the possible tariffs combined?
Look, there's always a downside scenario or a bear case. If you think for tariffs, the bear case is that ultimately you get a universal tariff 10% or higher on all imports to the U.S. Again, having the 25% on Canada and Mexico, that is consistent with a bear case if they persist. If you couple that also with, you know, significant, you know, job cuts from the government or, you know, a contraction of fiscal spending at the same time, you know, think of it this way. If you have a shock like a pandemic and instead of fiscal expansion, you consolidate, instead of, like, you know, providing support, you double down, then you can get a bad economic outcome. But that situation is by choice. That's a policy active choice to impose those tariffs. You know, if the administration goes forward and countries retaliate, you could get a trade war. But again, it's something you can avoid, unlike something that's a little bit more kind of a true random shock. So that's why ultimately I think most investors, and we still don't believe that's, you know, the, you know, kind of the right base case, that it's just not in anyone's interest to have that scenario play out. Any politician, you can't rule it out. Certainly things like this will happen. But that would really, to me, like, be the worst case scenario, is that ultimately the tariffs escalate into full-blown trade war. At the same time, fiscal policy, certainly the U.S., is not particularly supportive for the economy.
Great. Another one just came in, Jason, looks like it's for you. And the question asks, the U.S. and Europe inflation rates are the same, but our cost of funds is 200 basis points above Europe at this time. Has the Fed already made a policy error, and will they be chasing the euro interest rate decisions? Because we just talked about how the ECB cut rates today.
So there's a few things to think about. One, the levels of inflation matter, but it's also the direction of travel. What are the underlying inflation forces? I think in Europe, maybe the disinflation trends are more entrenched. You can have more confidence that inflation is going to fall there. Versus in the U.S., you know, it's still going lower, but it's sort of flatlined a little bit for the last six months. So I think that's one. There's a different dynamic that's important to consider. It's also important to consider, like, what is restrictive policy? And this gets into sort of like a broader, more sort of academic argument, like what is neutral? Neutral rate, I think we can say with some confidence, you know, to the extent it exists, is higher in the U.S. versus it is in Europe. So Europe, you know, the ECB has to cut more, you know, so their neutral level is lower than the U.S. So again, it's not an apples-to-apples kind of comparison. But the broader question, has the Fed made a mistake thus far? I think, look, we're not seeing real signs of a slowdown of economic activity. Mm-hmm. If it stays too long, if it's worries about inflation that's related to tariffs, even as the labor market's cracking, then I think that risks certainly a mistake. And depending on how quickly we see deteriorations, if the Fed doesn't move quickly, then that can cause a problem. I think so far they haven't, but the risk is obviously there. They move too slow if the economy slows down because of these all our other policy choices.
Great. Thank you, Jason. Another question coming in here, Nadia, maybe you can tackle this one. Talking about oil prices. Mm-hmm. And before I ask the question, oil right now is sitting at about $66 a barrel, down about 8% for the year so far. So the question goes, oil prices have given up all of this year's gains, with prices now trading at the lowest level since December amid the tariff news, et cetera. Also, OPEC Plus's announcement, it's going to start bringing back production in April. What's your view on oil companies, and do you expect further volatility?
Yeah, I think we will continue to see volatility near term around oil. Obviously, oil has pulled back on concerns around tariffs, potential for an economic slowdown, and then, you know, OPEC Plus bringing back barrels to the market, unwinding those production cuts. And so near term, we think that oil prices will remain volatile. But our commodities team does still have a positive, modestly constructive view on oil prices and think that Brent can get back at some point this year to $80. What does that mean for the equities? You know, obviously, lower oil prices aren't great for the equities. But when you think about it, we are neutral on energy. But when you think about it in terms of the U.S. producers have been quite disciplined, and they maintain that discipline. And this year, I'm going to only see a slight increase in production while CapEx remains pretty flat. So maintaining that neutral view on energy, because we do recognize that there are some risks around oil prices near term. But within energy, I would say we would highlight the integrated oil and gas companies. These companies tend to be a little bit more defensive in this sort of volatile environment.
Great. Nadia, thank you. That was it for the questions that we got in. If we didn't get to your question, we'll make sure to answer you directly via email. But let me thank you, Nadia Lovell, Jason Dreho. Great chat. Good stuff. Lots of headlines crossing. I don't think there were any headlines that crossed while we were sitting in here for the last 30 minutes, but I don't think it means that they won't before the end of the day. So we'll be keeping track of that. Good to see you both.
Great to hear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So yeah, and that is as I was saying, I was going to close with, we in CIO, especially my colleagues Nadia and Jason and the rest of the team, will be keeping track of all of the headlines because there is volatility and a lot of activity in the markets right now. So make sure you're staying tuned for all CIO content. Our next monthly live stream is going to be taking place on Thursday, April 3rd at the same time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And as I mentioned, all of our publications can be found on various websites like our House View, our CIO Alerts, and more. Plus, we've got all the multimedia as well, our videos and podcasts. You can take a look at our website, ubs.com/views or ubs.com/CIO. And as always, we encourage you to continue this conversation with your UBS financial advisor. Until next time, everybody, we wish you a great rest of your day. I'm Anthony Pastore from New York City. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you soon.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.